Thanks, Brother Nathan, and good evening, my dearly beloved brethren and sisters, and dear young people. Well, at our last class, we left David coming out of Jerusalem into the way of the wilderness, surrounded by friends and foes. And there were many of those, and there's many more that actually appeared on that journey, and we're going to see some of them again tonight. But the most amazing thing, I think, that emerged out of his departure from Jerusalem was the Spirit of Christ that was seen in his reactions, in his interactions with those he came in contact with, and in his prayers that is so abundantly recorded for us through the Psalms. We see, brothers and sisters, a meek submission in this man to the will of God, committing himself, like Peter was later to record, committing himself to the God who judges righteously. And after he'd endured the abuse of Shimei, I'd like you to come back to chapter 16 and verse 14. And I might say that we're going to move pretty quickly through a lot of things tonight, and we're only going to spend a little time in chapter 18, so don't get worried. We will pick up some stuff out of chapter 16 and 17 before we get there. And in verse 14, just picking up the story from where we were, we find that the king and all the people that were with him came weary and refreshed themselves there. In fact, there seems to be a word missing there, and most other translations actually put it in. The RSV says, for example, and the king and the people that were with him came weary, arrived weary at the Jordan, and refresh themselves there. So he comes down to the Jordan and refreshes himself and all the people there. But it's this little phrase, if you've not noticed it before, is this little phrase, "and all the people." You know, it's a recurring phrase. It starts in the story of this part of David's journey. It starts back in chapter 15, verse 17, when all the people went forth after the king and as he left. And if you have got a colour pencil at some stage, it's just worth doing, because we find that all the people are constantly put alongside the king. In fact, not alongside, they're put following the king. So this recurring phrase goes right through to the end of chapter 18. And here's another one of those cases in chapter 16, verse 14. The king and all the people that were with him came weary and refreshed themselves there. You know, it could have said that David just came to down there and the whole company refreshed themselves, but it just keeps on reminding us, brethren and sisters, that this record is actually here for us. There's a beautiful little parable here, too, because we are on this same journey that David was on, out of the city, so to speak, into the wilderness with our Lord. And our king is ahead, and we are with him as all the people. In some occasions, it says, "and all the people that were with him." It adds that extra phrase, which is so beautiful. All the people that were with him. We're going to see another illustration of that again tonight, which a little later, that's just absolutely beautiful in the record, that highlights the importance of this little parable and for us to get this message. Because this journey is written for us. Here's our king long ago and his greater son, who's gone through exactly the same journey, out of the city, through Gethsemane, into the wilderness, and finally, eventually to glory. But all the people are going to. And it's at that point that the record suddenly breaks. That's as much as we're going to get of David just for now. And a chapter and a half later, it picks it up again. And we're going to have a look at that in a minute. Chapter 17, partway through chapter 17, the story just continues. But the divine penman has said, "Right, now let's show you the other side." He pulls back the curtain that David can't see. And David can't see it for a very good reason. God's not going to let him see that. But he's going to let us see that, because we've got to understand and learn from this experience that David was going through. But what it's going to do now is to reveal What is unseen to David that's happening in the camp of Absalom back in Jerusalem? And we're going to see the angels here at work in answer to David's prayer, though he doesn't know what God has done with that prayer. All he did is those words came from his lips as he went over the crest of Olivet, turned the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. And then Hushai appeared and he sent him back into the city, and he knew nothing more than that. From then on, it was just the way of the wilderness. And it was a long, hard journey down to the Jordan. And then he got refreshment when he was there, but he still doesn't know what's happened. But this is what happened. An amazing set of circumstances here, recorded at the end of chapter 16 and through chapter 17. Where the outworking of God's providential hand is truly remarkable. Because Hushai gets back into Jerusalem just before Absalom gets there. Now, you remember how Hushai left David on Olivet? Okay, it wasn't very far for him to go back into the city. But when he left him, he had his clothes all ripped into shreds. And, you know, there were spies everywhere. There were people looking, watching. We know there were, because in chapter 17, we find there were eyes going everywhere, and they saw everything that was going on, and no doubt they were everywhere. How come Hushai actually got back into the city with rent clothes, tears and ashes on his head, and no one really noticed? And then he slips, changes his clothes and everything, and he gets in place just in time before Absalom and all his men come. Quite remarkable that that actually happened in that order. And then he gets into the palace and convinces, at the end of chapter 16, we're not going to go through this, he gets into the palace and he convinces Absalom that he's on his side. That was a mighty uphill battle. You would have thought how, even Absalom smelled a rat at the start, but eventually Absalom accepted Hushai. And then against all possible odds, he wins the confidence of Absalom, all the men of the court who decide on his plan over Ahithophel's. Can you imagine how Hushai must have actually felt when he was in that palace? He must have been internally trembling, though he had to stay calm on the outside. But after he'd gotten Absalom's confidence to start with and realised that he was a friend, the real challenge started. Have a look at chapter 16, verse 20. Because it was then that Absalom said to Ahithophel, "Give counsel among you what we shall do." You know, I think what Absalom was expecting, brothers and sisters, was for Ahithophel to come up with some great plan as to what to do. I don't think he expected what Absalom was going to say next. Nor do I think that Ahithophel actually expected, when he arrived at the palace, to find David's concubines there. So Ahithophel's advice, first and foremost, he gave two pieces of advice, but his first piece of advice involved David's concubines, whom he must have seen when he found that they were still in the palace, as being an amazing stroke of luck for him. And it became the first point of his advice to this new fledgling king. Because Ahithophel must surely have known the words that Nathan spoke to David. In fact, Ahithophel may well have actually been in the palace at the time. Who knows? But whether he was or not, he was such a close confidant of David that he would inevitably have known what Nathan had actually said to David. Just turn back a few pages, because just back in chapter 12, you remember the words well, because this is what God had said through Nathan. Verse 11, "Behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house, and I'll take thy wives before thine eyes and give them unto thy neighbour, and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of this son. For thou didst it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun." You know, I don't think there's any doubt that Ahithophel's advice was based on that statement from Yahweh before through the mouth of Nathan. Because even if he, as was a custom of the time, had advised the new king to go and take the former king's concubines or his wives, there was no real reason for him to spread the tent, as verse 22 of chapter 16 says, to spread the tent for Absalom on the top of the house so that everyone in Israel would see. You know, we've got this phrase, all Israel, on the side of all Israel, being picked up twice in verse 21, verse 22, and it comes directly from chapter 12, from the words of Nathan. So Ahithophel here is telling Absalom to fulfill that prophecy that he'd heard God give through Nathan. To take concubines was to take the kingship. Remember the incident with Abner, when Abner took the concubine of Ishbosheth, and he was accused, and he got a bit uppity about it. But this was the grossest insult that could ever be given to an eastern king. And it created an irreparable breach. And that's exactly what Ahithophel planned. Create a breach that can never be healed. You know, I think Ahithophel knew David well enough. He was a very, very close confidant and friend. And he knew David well enough that if there was any way that David could actually make up and join forces with Absalom again, if there's any way that peace could be made, David would find it. So Absalom was determined to make sure that that could never happen. If he was going to stand against David now, he knew that even his life was on the line. If anything came back, if Absalom and David made friends again, he would be the victim in the middle. So, but I think it smacks of more than just take over as king, use this as a sign. There's more in it than that. Because as you read those words in verse 21, you know, "Go unto thy father's concubines, which he hath left to keep the house, and all Israel shall hear that thou art abhorred of thy father. Then shall the hands of all that are with thee be strong." Oh, there's more than just take the concubines. There's an element of personal hatred coming here, of revenge, that's directed at David and his public humiliation. And there may well be a reason. In fact, we don't know that this is the reason for Ahithophel, but there is evidence that there's cause for a reason there, even if it was or wasn't. But because we know that Ahithophel was actually the grandfather of Bathsheba. Now, we know that because from putting two pieces of scripture together, 2 Samuel 23 and 2 Samuel 11, because in 2 Samuel 11, Bathsheba is said to be the daughter of Eliam, and in the list of mighty men of David, Eliam is listed as Eliam, the son of Ahithophel of Golan. So it's almost certain that Bathsheba was the granddaughter of Ahithophel. And when we think about it, this was a pretty big tragedy in the life of Bathsheba when David took her, and that radiated out and with the death of Uriah and the smashing of that little family. A little ewe lamb of Uriah was taken, and a little ewe lamb of Ahithophel, in a sense, was taken, and a family was destroyed, and shame was brought on him. And it may well have been that Ahithophel never, ever, ever could get over that. I think there's even more evidence that there's a personal vendetta here in the life of Ahithophel. Though there's a lot of other mixed motives in here as well that emerge. And that often happens, doesn't it, brothers and sisters? When people start to get consumed by one thing, all manner of other things start to go as as God's influence on their mind starts to fade and all manner of behaviours and characteristics start to emerge. Well, just coming back to 2 Samuel now in chapter 17, we find that Ahithophel gives his second piece of advice. And that is, we find here he says, and Ahithophel said unto Absalom, "Let me now choose out 12,000 men, and I'll rise and pursue after David this night, and I'll come upon him while he's weary and weak and wanting." And so this story goes on. You know, that's actually completely read wrong. Absolutely wrong. Let's read it properly. "Let me choose out 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue after David this night, and I will come upon him while he is weary and weak. And I will smite the king only, and I will bring back all the people unto thee, and the man whom thou seekest, as if all returned, and so all the people shall be in peace." Now, there's two things that are worth noticing in there, brothers and sisters. One is this personal vengeful thing, that spirit in the words of Ahithophel. Ahithophel was not a warrior. He was not a mighty man of David's army. He was probably a considerably older man. And why is he saying that he personally is going to select these 12,000 men? And why is he personally going to go out there? And why is he personally going to smite the king? But in the mix of all of that, did you notice that there's all the people, all the people, all the people in verse 2 and 3 twice? Oh, it's masked by his supposed concern about bringing all the people back. But it's dominated by the I. This man has gone a long way down a track in 10 years since those awful events that rocked the palace. And what he said, if you read it, is just verses 1, 2 and 3. Was wise advice in itself. In fact, as one writer said, it's a masterpiece alike of sagacity and wickedness. Beautiful little phrase. Wise on the surface, but with a depth of wickedness matching it. His advice, we read in verse 23 of the previous chapter, was like, when anyone asked of it, both Absalom or David, it was like asking at the oracle of God. But you know, brothers and sisters, the amazing thing is that it failed. Why? When it just tells us, when anyone asked him, it was like asking God. And yet, now he gives his advice and it absolutely crashes around his ears. Why? Why, having just been told that, do we find that it all falls over? Well, here's a very, very telling little paragraph from a commentator on the 2 Samuel. He says, "So strongly was Ahithophel impressed with the advantages of his own counsel that it seemed impossible that it could be opposed, far less rejected. One element only he left out of his reckoning, that as the mountains are around Jerusalem, so Yahweh Elohim is around about his people from henceforth forever. He forgot how many methods of protecting David God had already employed." Isn't that beautiful? Because that is the very essence of what happened. And he had forgotten that David was a man of prayer. In all his wisdom, he came up with this brilliant plan and he left God out. And he forgot that David, even though he had a weakness, even though David had sinned, even though David had actually affected his family, he had been forgiven. And God still showed favor to David. He failed, brothers and sisters, in this plan because of David's prayer. Do you know that? David's prayer foiled this. Chapter 17, verse 14. Turn the page. And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, this is after Hushai actually gave his advice, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For Yahweh had appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel, to the intent that Yahweh might bring evil upon Absalom. You know, it's the exact phrases there that of David's prayer. Yahweh, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. And here, God has done exactly that in answer to his prayer because of that relationship that David had with him. And Ahithophel completely put that out of the question and working solely on just the organisation of his mind and the brilliance of his as a statistician, he just completely came unstuck because here God was at work. There was this same writer that said this, how easily may God, when he pleases, defeat the most able schemes of his enemies. He doesn't need to create weapons to oppose them. He has only to turn their own weapons against themselves. How many times has that been repeated down through history? Again and again and again. And will yet be repeated. And the world will see that repeated again. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh, and Yahweh shall have them in derision, said Psalm 2. Yet to be fulfilled and has been fulfilled down through the ages. You know, brothers and sisters, there's a profound lesson here that we ought not to miss just moving over. We ought not to just focus on David and Ahithophel and Absalom and all what they're doing and Hushai's counsel. Just let's stop and pause. And I think this is a record that just needs to be very meditative. You know, we're not just going to learn about the life of David here. This life of David is something to take with us, to think, to mull over, to chew, to see where it actually is leading us and how it can affect our lives. But I think there's a really profound lesson here because we, just like Ahithophel, can organise our lives and plan and do all manner of things so that there appears to be no way of failure. You know, in fact, we don't plan to fail, do we? We actually plan to succeed and we do lots of things in life. And we might think, oh, well, they're not very spiritual things. They're things that we just have to do. But We can get to the point where we actually trust and have confidence in our ability to organise things well and to make sure that things don't fall over. And then we can put insurance in place and then we can do this and that and something else and we can make sure that this will happen. But we might too just forget, like Ahithophel, that it's the mountains around about Jerusalem. So Yahweh is in control of everything. God is greater than any of our plans, brothers and sisters. He's greater than our intellect, as we well and truly know, but sometimes we don't realise. I believe it's a grave and perilous problem of our age because there are very few, very few generations in history who have had the money, the influence, the intellect, the skills, in order to be able to sort things out and organise and control our environment. But look where we find David, brothers and sisters. I think this is where we've got to go. And we've got to read this record and not just see Absalom and not just see Ahithophel, but see what the problem with them was and then look to David. Because he was the forerunner of our Lord. And we've already seen the Spirit of our Lord appear in his life. And where do we find David, brethren and sisters? He had more money, he had more intellect, he had more skill than all of those. And where is he? He's in tears. He's in prayer. He's on his knees. He has no confidence to organise the direction of his life. But he has tremendous confidence that God can. And he learned to accept God's hand. And that's where we've got to get, brothers and sisters. The environment that we're living in, this world that we're living in, is robbing us of that spirit of trust. It's something that is so difficult for us to get, to let go and truly let God actually work in our lives. And I can just imagine our Lord poring over this record over and over and seeing the story and seeing the people and seeing the characters, because he was going to actually walk this same path and some of the same characters were going to appear in his life. He didn't know at that stage who they would be in the early years when he's reading this. But as his life moved on, he would start to see the Absaloms and the Ahithophels. And it wasn't very long, even after he'd chosen his disciples, that he saw an Ahithophel start to appear. Just turn the page to chapter 17, verse 23. Because this is Ahithophel's end. And when Ahithophel saw his counsel was not followed, he saddled his ass, arose, got him home to his house, to his city, put his household in order, hanged himself, died, was buried, and that's the end of Ahithophel. Very clinical. He could see no way through his logical, reasoned way that he worked out his wisdom to get out of the dilemma that he'd gotten himself into. He could blame all sorts of people. But in the end, brothers and sisters, Ahithophel's downfall was not just his revenge back to David. We're told what it was. Here it is in verse 23. When he saw that his counsel was not followed, it was just pride. Stubborn pride. And God hates it. Hates it. But Ahithophel, though he might have felt like that, had so badly in the process misunderstood his king. He failed to read David right, because I don't think there's any doubt that David would have received him back and forgiven him if he'd gone to David. Here is the blind and stubborn heart of man. He didn't want to entertain a thought that he had to come down from his high and mighty position where everybody worshipped him. He didn't want to entertain accepting the grace of God or of humbling himself under the mighty hand of God. You know, and as Jesus actually read that record, brethren and sisters, he prepared himself for the time when another traitor would arise in the life of the greater than David. You know, the parallel between Ahithophel and Judas is absolutely stunning. There's just a few of the things. Both very close friends of their Lord. Both joined the enemy. Both deceived the unsuspecting. Both planned to act at night. Both hanged themselves. And both are linked in the Psalms. And the Psalms, that second column where Judas is, John 13, Acts 1, and so on, quote those other Psalms that are in the first column. So there's an amazing connection here, and Jesus must have pored over that and thought long and hard about it in preparation for him being able to deal with what for David was an exceedingly bitter and difficult circumstance in his life. Well, Hushai's counsel, that when it came for his turn to give that, was clear evidence that God was at work, because I think it was amazing that Hushai was even asked for his counsel. After all, Absalom had called Ahithophel before the rebellion at all, when it was gaining momentum, before they'd gotten to Jerusalem. And now Hushai just rocks up out of the blue. They're not sure which side he's on. And after Ahithophel was given his counsel, Hushai is asked for his. That can be nothing else but the hand of God doing that. Why? Why on earth would anyone do that with such an incredible plan that Ahithophel had actually given? But he gets an opportunity, and He's amongst all those, in fact, some who were clearly must have doubted his allegiance, but he very carefully and diplomatically undermined Ahithophel's counsel and then magnified all the difficulties of Ahithophel's plan and the prowess of David's past and how mighty a man he was, and then the key point of his advice was that he knew Absalom's besetting sin was vanity. And what he did is just played on Absalom's pride and vanity and gave him a picture of glory in the end. He said, get the whole... It's chapter 17, verse 11. Therefore I counsel that all Israel be generally gathered unto thee, from Dan even to Beersheba, as the sand that's upon the sea for multitude, and that thou go out to battle in thine own person. So get the whole nation involved. Absalom, you go out the front. And then we're going to have this stealth attack. And you'll get the honour for that. And if it goes wrong, we'll have another plan. We'll drag the city that David's in into the sea. Absalom was fascinated by such a stupid plan. Really, it was. Fascinated by this spectacle of the whole nation behind him as the great victor. His head was so big he couldn't see anything else. But you know, Hushai didn't rest and think that it was all over and that his work was done. He knew that God had worked to get him that far. And he knew the fickleness and pride of men. So he very quickly got a message to David through the priest's sons. And they, we're not going to look at that in any detail, but eventually a message reaches David in chapter 17, verse 21. And there we read, and it came to pass after they had departed, they came up out of the well and they went and told King David and said unto David, arise and pass over the water, for thus hath Ahithophel counseled against you. They didn't come to him and say, this is what Hushai counseled, and they actually accepted Hushai's counsel. Hushai was wise enough to make sure that Ahithophel's counsel got to David, because he knew that, well, anything could happen with people that were unstable and as ungodly as Absalom and those that were around him. So David had had a chance, as he was now down at the River Jordan. Verse 22 says, and then David arose, and all the people that were with him. Here it comes again. Here's that little phrase. And they passed over Jordan by the morning light. There lacked not one of them that was not gone over Jordan. Now, if you read that carefully, brothers and sisters, that tells us several things. You know, there's a lot of drama hidden behind that verse, because that's saying that whole of that company passed over in one night. Before dawn, the whole lot of them had got over there. That is, from the point of getting a message, they had all passed over the Jordan that night. Imagine that, at night. Everyone's frightened. They've got children. They've got captains. They've got all sorts. Everyone's uncertain. No one knows what's going to happen. No one knows when it's going to end, how it's going to end. But let's read it again. What's God telling us? Then David arose and all the people that were with him, and they passed over Jordan by the morning light. There was not one of them that was not gone over Jordan. What's God telling us? Not one of them was left behind. And that was a result of David's trust. It was a result of David's influence and of David's prayers. All he had done is received a message from Hushai, who had managed to get into the palace, and it had encouraged his heart. David knew, brothers and sisters, David knew where this would end. David was not afraid, though there might have been some fear amongst the people that were going over. The very fact that not one of them was left behind by the time they'd got out of the shadow of darkness would have to David meant that God was with him. And it confirmed his confidence that was already placed firmly in God. And it was from this very moment, brothers and sisters, that the tide began to flow against Absalom, and reassurance returned to David and to all the hosts that were with him. You know, David knew nothing. Just look at the way this record is written. David arose and went over the Jordan, right? Verse 22. And then it breaks and says, and when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he went and hung himself. Verse 24. And then David came to Mahanaim. Like, this verse 23 is stuck in the middle of this, of David going over and then going on to Mahanaim. But David didn't know anything about verse 23. That's just God telling us, drawing back the curtain and saying, well, I'm going to tell you what really happens in these situations, brothers and sisters. What you're going to find is that the situation will be rather dire in your life, and you'll get little inklings that God might be actually blessing you, but it will still be difficult to perceive. And then you will move on in life and do something else. But just know that in the middle of all that, my angels are working furiously. And they're dealing with the wicked, and they will. You don't need to worry about that. You just worry about your confidence in me, and I'll do the rest. It's remarkable, isn't it? So from David's experience out of the wilderness was born a few of the most beautiful of the Psalms. And we've had a look at some of these in our last couple of classes. But I'd like you just to hold your hand in 2 Samuel and go over to Psalm 4 for a moment. And while we've looked at a few verses of Psalm 4 before, I'm only going to pick a couple of things. But what I want to do, brothers and sisters, is just to see if we can capture at this point, when David is now passing over and all of the people have gone over Jordan and he comes to Mahanaim, let's imagine what's going through his mind. We know this because Psalm 3 and 4 were written at the time when David was fleeing from Absalom. And look at his spirit in verse 8 of chapter 4. I will both lay me down in peace and sleep, for thou, Yahweh, only makest me to dwell in safety. That's against the background, brothers and sisters, of all manner of people, of evil people rising up and him not being able to do anything about it. He can still lay himself down and sleep. This spirit of trust, of surrender, that turns into a spirit of hope and optimism is what we've got to find from David, brothers and sisters. We need to open our hearts and soak this in. Just listen to David as he works through these calamities. Psalm 3 is a classic example. Verse 1. Yahweh, how are they increase that trouble me? Many are they that rise up against me. Many there be that say of my soul, there is no help for him in God. Think about that. He's overwhelmed. He's crushed. He's hurt. But he resolves it in his own mind. But remember, and his mind goes back, thou, O Yahweh, art a shield for me. My glory and the lifter up of my head. So he starts to think about who God really is. Does he need to worry about men if he's got God for his shield? If God is his glory? If God lifts up his head, what does it matter if people try and push it down? And so it moves from there, verse 4. I cried unto Yahweh with my voice, and he heard me out of his holy hill. You know, David is saying, Selah, pause and think about that and put it in the context of where he was at the time. He's in dire circumstances and he actually doesn't know the end. He doesn't know half of what's happened in the palace. God has kept him from all that. God has not told him all those details. But what an amazing man this is. Verse 4. Oh, we read verse 4. Verse 5. I laid me down and slept. I waked, for Yahweh sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people that have set themselves against me round about. Arise, O Yahweh, and save me, my God, for thou hast smitten all mine enemies upon the cheekbone. What an amazing transformation, brothers and sisters. Now we've got to translate that into our own experience, because at times we get very anxious about lots of things, about things that we can't do much about, really. And it might be because people say all kinds of things. It might be things that are totally beyond us to actually sort out. But as Brother Harry Tennant says, many who are troubled cast themselves upon their beds or stretch themselves in weakness. But how many sleep? The seeking eyes of enemy forces and the march of soldiers of the uprising were no terror to David once he had cast himself upon God. You know, we're not to think, brothers and sisters, that David didn't at times have sleepless nights. He may have. But when his mind had gone through the process of Psalm 3 that he put down for our benefit, then he could sleep. How often do we allow fears and oppressions to pursue us through the hours of daylight and to haunt our hours of sleep? How often do we take our cares to bed and find them refreshed and strong in the morning whilst we ourselves are fatigued through anxiety? Cast thy burden on the Lord is the counsel of Scripture. You know, it's not just the counsel of Scripture. It's the counsel of David. And you know, brothers and sisters, it's the counsel of David in one of the Psalms when he's fleeing from Absalom. Quite amazing. Come back to chapter 17, verse 24. And then David came to Mahanaim. Oh, just like that. Click your fingers and you're at Mahanaim. Do you know where Mahanaim was? Mahanaim's an awful long way away. I don't know whether I've got a pointer here. You're going to have to find Mahanaim for yourself. It's up there on the east of Jordan, halfway up. And David was down here at the crossing of Jordan. That's where we left him. And just suddenly it says, and David came to Mahanaim. Oh, well, he came to Mahanaim. Mahanaim was a trip up the Jordan Valley and then through the river Jabbok Valley, and then up onto the mountains, up into where Mahanaim was. And it appears almost certainly that David deliberately went there. He headed for Mahanaim. He had decided to go to Mahanaim. Why? Was it that there was a great fortress there? Well, yeah, apparently the town was fairly well fortified, and it may well have been built up to that state when Ishbosheth was made that his sort of temporary capital after the death of Saul, and it may well have been that the walls were still strong, and that was... Do you think that's why David went there? Having just read Psalm 3 and 4 and knowing what David's spirit was through here, was David going to Mahanaim because there was a very strong fortress and he could put all his people inside and he'd be safe? That's not the David we know here. It's not the David we read between the lines. This place, brothers and sisters, was named by Jacob. And I don't think there's any doubt, there's no doubt in my mind, absolutely, that that's the reason he was going there. He was going there because of Jacob. Because Jacob's experience there at Mahanaim was that when he had gotten to that place and he was anxious and not knowing what to do and making all sorts of plans and worrying about what Esau was going to do, there the angels of God appeared to him and he said, I'm going to call this place Mahanaim because I've seen the host of God and they've joined with my host, and now I can trust in God because I've seen this host. He called it two hosts or two camps. That's the name of the place and that's its history. Because there Jacob learned not to trust his own plans, but to trust God to deliver. You know, brothers and sisters, I find that remarkable because almost every single psalm that David wrote through this whole period, one of its dominating themes is his trust in God. And now he heads to the very place that memorializes what it means to trust God? Do you think his motive was right? You know, if we have any doubt that God actually was behind this decision of his, it's soon blown away as we read on. Look at verse 27. And it came to pass, when David was come to Mahanaim, that Shobi the son of Nahash of Rabbah of the children of Ammon, and Machir the son of Amiel of Lodabar, and Barzillai the Gileadite of Rogalim, brought beds and basins and earthen vessels and wheat and barley and corn and honey and butter and for the people that were with him. For they said, the people is hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. What an amazing thing. It just says, it's told us that he's already come to Mahanaim. But then it repeats it in verse 27. And it came to pass when he was come to Mahanaim that these men came to him. Do you know, brothers and sisters, that not one of those lived in Mahanaim. Not one of those three named people lived in Mahanaim. Those three men did not have any connection with each other. In fact, on the map here you can see that here's Rabbi Ben Ammon down the bottom, which is where, Shobai, the son of Nahash, of Rabbah, down here, right down the south. There's Rogalim up the top, and Lodabar in another place up the top. These men did not live in the same town. They didn't live in Mahanaim. But when David got to Mahanaim, they all independently converged on Mahanaim because they'd heard David was there. And they brought all these things for the people that were with him. You know, there was not a single thing common with these men except their love for David and their deep appreciation of what he was and what he stood for. I was going to spend a little time. Does anyone know anything about Shobai? So this is a good little exercise for you to do. We haven't really got time to do this either now or to even spend any time. But Shobai's background is really quite interesting. You know, he's from Rabbah. He's one of the Ammonites. What on earth is an Ammonite doing coming to David here? Especially after David had so severely had to deal with the Ammonites. That's an interesting question to ask. I'm not going to answer it now. And Machir was the host who'd cared for Mephibosheth for all those years before eventually David took him into his own house. And he would have no doubt heard that David was coming and wanted to show his appreciation for David's generosity. And Barzillai is a very interesting man that we'll meet further on in the record of David's life. And who I think probably was the main benefactor here. Because he alone is singled out by David when he talks to Solomon at the end of his days. But whatever happened, brothers and sisters, and whatever their motivation in coming, it was just truly remarkable that these men just happened to appear in the record. You can imagine what sort of amazing encouragement that must have been to David. Because I have no doubt that David saw that as the hand of God, the providence of God in a weary land, men coming and providing for him. But you know, verse 29 I think is really fascinating. It says that they came, they brought this stuff for the people that were with him to eat, for they said, the people is hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. Now, they brought it for David and the people, but they said the people is hungry. Very interesting. Because I think there's a very great lesson here. And Jesus saw that. And perhaps there's an echo in some of his words that memorialized this principle. But when there was a need, that brethren make sure they meet that need. Just hold your hand there and go to Matthew 25. You know these words really well. But look at the correspondence with this. Maybe Jesus even had in the back of his mind This amongst other incidents from the Old Testament, when telling them of the parable of the sheep on his right hand and the goats on the left. And he says in verse 34, "Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For when I was hungered, he gave me meat. When I was thirsty, he gave me drink. When I was a stranger, he took me in." They're all the things that David was and his men. But look at verse 40. "And the king shall answer those that are on the right hand and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me." You see, brothers and sisters, what's so amazing is that record back in Samuel says that these people spontaneously did it. They hadn't been asked. They just saw a need and acted. They didn't have any gain out of this themselves, but they said to themselves, "The people is hungry and weary and thirsty." They didn't say, "The king, and if we go and minister to the king, he might look after us later." They said to themselves, "He is the least of our brethren that are in need. I'll do something." Quite amazing, isn't it? The spontaneous generation of the hearts of these men. But David comes, and let's just come now to chapter 18, and we're only going to spend a few minutes on this, because the story of Absalom's death is really, I think, a great parable in a sense. What it appears in verse 1 is that many more gathered around David, and his army got to quite some size, and he divided it into three, probably for tactical reasons, but maybe he was thinking about Gideon, who knows. And though he knew God was with him and that his confidence was in God, yet still he feared the outcome of this confrontation, because he knew that either way this was going to be painful. If his men were defeated, that would break David's heart. But if Absalom was to be killed, that also was going to devastate him. And we find there in verse 5, as they left and the king was watching them go out of the gates, David the king says to Joab and Abishai and Ittai, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom." And all the people heard it. They all heard it for sure, because we know that it came back to Joab in verse 12. The same phrase or similar phrase came back. The issue for David here was coming to a head. You know, for the first 10 to 12 years, brothers and sisters, Absalom had dominated David's life. Absalom had dominated the entire record of 2 Samuel through that period as well. This is the period of Absalom. And Absalom had dominated David's life. He was an unthankful, ungodly, and arrogant son, and yet David still loved him. And we might say, how? Well, emotions go beyond just reason. There was certainly no feelings like that in Joab's heart, and when he had an opportunity, he dealt with him. And it was God's justice, really, that fell on Absalom's head. It was God's victory that day, because it says the wood devoured more people than the sword. It wasn't David's men going around killing thousands of people. But that day we find there were 20,000 men slain, and most of them were slain because they got entangled in the thickness of the woods. So it was Yahweh's judgment on what was going on. And then we find in verse 9 that Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode upon a mule, and the mule went under the thick boughs of a great oak, and his head got caught hold on the oak. You know, you think, here's Absalom. The picture we have of Absalom at the end is riding on a mule, still pretending to be king. The mule was a symbol of kingship. And he's alone. Oh, where's all the thousands that were with him? Well, there's 20,000 of them that are dead, and others fleeing in all kinds of... He had thousands upon thousands around him. Where's Hushai's vision for Absalom now? Great Absalom's vision of him being the victor with all these people shouting his accolades. Here he is now, caught by his head or his hair in a tree, because that was his problem. His thinking, his selfish, vain, arrogant attitude. And there's God's judgment, God's last word. The trees of the ground took the men who had followed him, and the trees of nature actually took that man because God was in it. And Job finished him off with three darts. In fact, the word darts isn't normally translated darts. It's just the word for a stick, and it's actually used for the rod of correction. So here, Joab actually just plunged three of these rods. He hadn't had enough rods through his life, that's for sure. David hadn't administered enough on him, and he had three plunged through him. And then verse 16 tells us that Joab blew a trumpet, and the people returned, and they took Absalom and cast him into a great pit. Oh, how significant is this? And laid a very great heap of stones upon him. And all Israel fled, everyone to his tent. He was left alone under a heap of stones. And that's where flesh will end, brothers and sisters. And Absalom was just the epitome of flesh. And now he's crucified. God had caught him in a tree. And the rod had been plunged through his heart. And he's destroyed. And the memorial to the pride of man is this great heap of stones, just like Achan had over him. It was a monument to his folly, to his filial ingratitude, and to the impersonation of revenge in its most unnatural shape, says one writer. But David's back in Mahanaim waiting for news, and he's anxiously waiting. Why was he anxiously waiting? You know, David knew the outcome of that battle. David knew that God was on his side. David knew that his men would win. He would not be defeated that day. He knew absolutely. He was convinced. His Psalms tell us that. So why was he anxious? Why could a man who could put all those things in God's hand and sleep without any worry? Well, here's the reason. And it comes back again. Look at verse 29. And the king said to the first of the runners that comes back, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" And then to the second one, verse 32, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" This was the burning question. David wasn't anxious about his own life. He wasn't anxious about the life of his men. He knew they were in God's hands. And then the news comes, and there's uncontrollable grief. The king, verse 33, was much moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, thus he said, "O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee, O my son Absalom." Why was David so uncontrollably in grief, brothers and sisters? Absalom was a wicked, rebellious, unthankful, deceitful son. But you know, he was still David's son. And David always had the attitude that while there was life, there was hope. It didn't matter who they were. But there's more to it than that, because David was reminded of Nathan's words, "Sword shall never depart from your house, David." And as he uncontrollably let out his grief over Absalom, he knew this was God's hand. The knife of Yahweh cut him open. For a third time. Because he knew that Absalom was a casualty of his own sin. What did heartless Job know of that? When Job came and shook him and said, "Wake up to yourself. Get back to being king." Oh, true, he probably should have. But what did Job know of what was going through David's heart? But you know, there's more than that, brothers and sisters. And I think if we don't see it, we miss the great point of this whole long saga
of Absalom's life. Because played out before David in Absalom was a manifestation of David's own sin and of his own natural human nature. Absalom was a replica of David, but with no spiritual dimension. And while he actually locked horns with Absalom, there was no way he could win. The flesh which resists God's will must be crucified. And that day, out in the woods, David died. The old man, symbolically crucified, buried under stones. And David finally was released from this huge burden. But it was in the process, it was a painful experience, as it is for all of us, brothers and sisters. Why didn't God take Absalom out earlier? Because David needed Absalom. God used him for those 10 to 12 years to perfect David. It was a harrowing experience, brothers and sisters, but God does the same for us. You know, in viewing David's life, many have felt the need to castigate David, to criticize him for his weaknesses, for all his faults which stand out in the record. But you know, brothers and sisters, we have to be very careful, because God does not do that, except in the matter of Uriah. But what God wants us to see is the process he used to perfect his saints. He wants us to think about and to look at David's mind. God will use our own inadequacies and our own failings like he used David's. He will use our own families, our own friends, our own enemies to break our selfish spirit. And he will lead us through that wilderness, painful though it might be. And he will help us to crucify that old man and leave it under a pile of stones. Because God has great things for us in store, just like he had for David. You know, we know that's right, because we get to the end of Absalom's life and we find Ahithophel and Absalom and 20,000 of their followers who were self-pleasers, arrogant, vain, unthankful, not affected by the word of God, are lying in the dust. And David, though he had previously sinned, is meek and humble and responsive. And he's alive and victorious with a crown on his head. And that's the story of our lives. And I think it's the reason why we have so much detail of David through this whole period when Absalom plagued his life.